All right, welcome listeners to another episode of Pas de Deux. This is our first COVID-19 episode that we're doing on Zoom. I'm your host, Clara.
And I am Michael Mahaney.
Today we're interviewing Kyla Barkin and Aaron Sellison from the Barkin Sellison Project, which is a New York City-based contemporary dance company founded in 2009 that presents the choreography of co-founders and artistic directors Kyla Barkin and Aaron Sellison through live performance and workshops.
Woo!
Woo! The company strives to remove barriers and create a shared experience between the creative team and audience members, allowing for a more inclusive and memorable event. We can't wait to dive in and learn more about how that's accomplished. Kyla Barkin was raised in Tempe, Arizona, and studied with La Mariquilla at the Academia de Ballet Flamenco in Granada, Spain, then received her BA in dance from UCLA. Miss Barkin has toured and presented work internationally, and she is the recipient of multiple awards. Aaron Sellison is originally from Green Bay, Wisconsin, and received his BFA in dance performance from Butler University, which I believe ran my study abroad program. Fun fact.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
His choreographic work has been presented across the U.S., and his teaching and performance career has taken him across the U.S. and abroad. Both Kyla and Aaron have been involved in the creation of dance films as well, which leads us to their current work. Accidental Suite premiered in June as one of five dance films in BSP's Titles Project, and the audience voted to have it expanded and presented live. The extended version of Accidental Suite was supposed to premiere at Riverside Church this coming Friday, prompting this interview on March 20th, but it has unfortunately now been indefinitely postponed due to the coronavirus, which we're all dealing with and floundering a little bit. And actually, on that note, I'd like to just read a little bit more of the description of Accidental Suite because it feels so ironic and timely in a weird way right now in light of the social distancing that we're all kind of experiencing and practicing. So the description of Accidental Suite continues on. Born from raw experimentation and structured improvisation, this performance installation builds relational tension through increasing levels of contact. Featuring nine dancers and an original score by Zach Sellison, this 75-minute celebration event would have included 30 minutes of live performance wrapped in a pre- and post-party. Accidental Suite evokes chance encounters, near misses, and the magnetic push and pull of relationships from start to finish. It sounds fascinating.
So good. Clara, that was a really great read. That was very good.
It's weird to not be able to see you guys when I'm reading because I'm looking at a different screen. So let's start from the beginning like we always do. Welcome so much, Aaron and Kyla. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Glad to have you virtually here. And just describe for us, since we always kind of start with your background, how did each of you come into the dance world? How did you manage to build such a deep collaboration together, including a successful company, which is not easy to do in the dance world?
Yes. Well, I will say that we're very happy to have made it past the 10-year mark recently. So that's pretty exciting for, as you said, a dance company in New York.
Congratulations. That's huge. That's huge in the dance world, yes.
So how did I come into dance? By declaration? By declaration as a three-year-old, I announced that I would be a ballerina, not unlike many young little girls. And my parents, they believed in me and they wanted to support me and let me find my own way. So they took me to a dance class and I exited that dance class and said, that was not ballet. I said ballet, that was creative movement and that's not going to work for me. And so they found a ballet studio two doors down and there I took class for most of my childhood. When I was 16, my mother was actually running a study abroad program in Spain, and I went to live in Spain, in southern Spain, which is where I got really passionate about flamenco. And at the end of my time in Andalusia, in Spain, in studying with La Mariquilla, who was a very famous flamenco teacher at the time, I assume might still be, I have lost touch recently, but she said to me at the end, you know, this is not a hobby. And she said, you have to continue this. And I took her very seriously. And when I returned to the United States, I enrolled in an advanced youth program at Arizona State University that allowed students to take classes if they were pretty much finished or abbreviating their last year in high school. And I was told that I would have to take modern dance. And that was like, oh, that's like that creative movement stuff. So they said, well, you know, if you want to go to a university, you're going to have to take modern dance. You're not going to be able to limit yourself to jazz and ballet, so get over it. And I did. And I took class. And on our first break, I found myself giving myself modern class at home because I had just fallen in love with it and realized that it felt amazing. And it had so much of a broad spectrum in terms of interests and crossover of influences and just such a big realm of creative application. So I just went with that and decided that was where it was and that's where it would be. And whatever it took, I would pursue it. Fast forward to New York City, came here straight after college and decided I would dance for about 10 years for other companies and learn what I could about the industry and what it really took to not just be a dancer, but what went into creating a company. And then when it was time to carve our own pathway. And I'll let Aaron say a little bit more about his background and then how we met and formed the company together.
Thank you. Yeah.
Great.
So, you know, my story is not 100% dissimilar to hers in that I started young. I remember seeing Sammy Davis Jr. on TV. And I wanted tap dance. I wanted tap shoes. And my mother, being the person she is, said, I'll get you tap shoes, but you need to take tap class. And so I took tap class from the age of 5 until I was like a junior in high school. And, you know, along with like a little jazz and other things in the studio that they offered. But I grew up in Green Bay where, I mean, it's a football town. Go Pack,
football.
Go. But yeah. It never occurred to me that dance was a profession that one could pursue. I mean, just, I never met anybody that did that. It never even occurred. I loved dance, but I also studied guitar at a young age. And my teacher was teaching classical guitar. And I also fell in love with that. And I had decided by the time I was a junior in high school that I was going to become a guitarist. My mother said to me, you know, you love dancing. If you want to take a dance class in college, they might make you audition before you can even like sign up for the class. So you should go to the local ballet school and you should just take a ballet class over the summer before you go to college. Well, this is before my senior year of high school. You know, you should take a ballet class and see what it's about so that if you have to audition for that in college, you can at least take those classes and have fun. And so the summer before my senior year, I took a ballet class and I fell in love. It was amazing. I had never taken like a structured technical ballet class, but still it never occurred to me that I could become a professional dancer until the teacher, you know, he came up to me after class and he said, young man, I need to talk to your mother, bring her in. And so she came in and, you know, he started talking about I can get you into a college program in a year. And if not in a year, in 2 years, you have a lot of raw talent. And all of a sudden the wheels started turning and I was like, what do you mean college for dance? Like, oh, and you know, the light bulb went off and my young mind at the time was like, okay, well you could become a guitarist or a dancer. You have maybe 20 years to be a dancer. You have the rest of your life to become a guitarist. Do dance first. And you can always play guitar, which, you know, of course in retrospect is a little bit naive, but I went all in and never looked back. And I went to Butler University, which is a very classical program, which is run like a conservatory. And, you know, it was full of a lot of hardships, you know, the body not cooperating. And I didn't realize at the time how my height might have been a disadvantage in the ballet world. I'm only 5'6". But, you know, I persisted. And as soon as I got out of college, I joined a modern dance company. There was a local modern dance company in Indianapolis run by David Hochoy, who was a very instrumental teacher of mine as I was a young man. And I never looked back. Modern dance seems to me to have all the variety and the medium itself is just so flexible and malleable that I fell in love and it's where I've continued to push, you know, my creative juices. And eventually I decided that I needed to move to New York. I needed to see, you know, what I was made of. I was confident that I could do it, but you never know. So I came here and lo and behold, it worked out, you know, thanks to family support and support of people around me, just like emotional support. Because it's a really hard world in New York, especially, you know, when you're starting out, it can be really, really demoralizing to feel like you have it and not be getting it. But slowly but surely things, you know, came around. And after, I think it was really the first company in New York that was a full-time company was Carolyn Dorfman's company. And Kyla joined the company at the same time I did. And, you know, we had a lot in common with the way we moved. Not that we had the same background. She has a background that is so different from mine. But there was something very simpatico about the way we moved together. And eventually we got into a relationship and we were talking about things. And I said, I wanted to start a dance company. And she was like, I want to start a dance company too, but I wouldn't know. You know, and we just started off making duets together. And, you know, one thing turned into another. We were funding it ourselves in the beginning, but we were like committed to it. And slowly but surely it evolved into this company that it is today, you know, 10 years later. I'm sure Kyla can actually expand upon that more than I can, but it's been a really great journey as we've evolved, not only as artists, but as people, and trying to think of where I want to go with it. But
well, I have a question for you actually. Yeah. So looking at both of your backgrounds, before we get into the show and how you choreograph and that sort of thing, I'm just so curious. You obviously joined the same company, you started dancing together there, but you coming from a rhythmic tap background, and then before you went into a more formal training, and Kyla coming from this sort of ballet background, do those sort of styles play into each other? Do you fundamentally have different foundational ways of creating, or is it modern dance just like ultimately took over your careers and lives and that's where you go?
Well, it's a little bit of both, you know, maybe a little bit of this in my background. She has a little bit of that and it comes together. You know, all dance really is a hybrid of other dance that came before it. Right. Cause every artist takes what they did before and they bring something new to it, or they try to bring something new to it. And so what's wonderful about working in a collaboration is that I have all of her experience to draw upon and she has all of my experience to draw upon. And as we, you know, talk about what we want to create and as we go deeper, we each have different strengths. And so we help each other to like fulfill the vision. You know, there's things that she comes up with that I would never think of. And there's other things I'm sure that I think of that, you know, wouldn't occur to her. And because we're committed to collaborating and working together, feel like it just elevates everything that we do. I feel like it's really a gift to have an artist that you connect with, that you can continue to work with, and that you can develop a relationship with. And we've also worked in other dance companies together. Janice Brenner is another very major mentor of both of ours. And while we still have those different backgrounds and those different strengths, you almost begin to think alike. So we sit there in rehearsal and we see something and you know, I'll say, no, I think it should be more like that. And she can step in there and finish my sentence half the time. It's really amazing how over time you begin to almost share one brain with a person. It's a very interesting process.
And I love that you said that you never imagined making a career in dance and had some other ideas of where you might go long term. And I feel like you kind of went where life pulled you. And then Kyla, I don't know how literally you meant this, but you said when you arrived in New York, you intended to dance with other people and understand how they made a company and how they kind of made it work and I guess how the gears turn. That's so intentional. I feel like few people come to dance trying to understand how they can, I guess, continue a career or create a company or something beyond when they're dancing. How do you think that, I guess, that experience or those observations led to you guys forming a company and being successful with it?
I would say I was quite literal, actually. I had a plan. I had it in my head that this was how you do it. No one told me that. I just had it in my head for some reason, same way I had it in my head that once you move out from home and go to college, you like don't go back home to live.
No, why would you?
I don't know. All my friends would go home for the summer and I'd say, oh, I never thought of that. Not like my parents said, don't come home. They were like, please come home. But yeah, I would just get things in my head and that was it. So I really believed that, well, I always wanted a company. I was choreographing from, you know, as soon as I could walk and declaring that I would be a dancer and forcing all of my childhood friends to make dances with me. And so that was always something that I engaged in. And then when I decided to be a professional dancer, I just had it in my head. This is what you do. You go to New York, you dance for other people, you like figure out how everything works, and then you make your company. And then maybe you open a school. And I grew up in, you know, in Arizona, where it's not like New York, where that was actually a known pathway. So where I grew up, actually, when I would tell people that I wanted to be a dancer, I would get one of two reactions. One, but you're so smart. Why would you do that? And sometimes they meant they thought I was going to be a stripper, because in Phoenix at that time, that was what dancer meant. So, you know, they were like, oh God, you're so smart. Why would you do that? And other people actually meant it like, why are you not going to be an attorney? Why are you not going to be a doctor? And so, you know, I would have to answer differently to those things. But really, I just thought that was how you did it. That was what happened. And so I embarked on that mission. And right around when I joined, I had been doing choreography projects off and on since I had moved to New York from the first year. But when I joined Carolyn's company, I began to really see how a more full-time company worked. Before that, I was very loyal to a lot of choreographers and their companies, but they were a little bit more loosely structured. And Carolyn's company was very tightly structured and very interesting, in fact, how she runs her company. And I learned a lot. So going into that company, I had certain things in mind, in addition to just wanting to dance for that company. And then I began to feel now is the time. I began to feel like, although I respected her choices, they weren't the choice that I would have made, which of course automatically brings to mind like, well, then make your own. Don't expect anyone to do what you would do. Do it yourself. And so I realized now is really the time. And the dance community at that time, which was around 2007, 8, 9-ish, was really hungry for something fresh. And as Aaron had said, you know, we found a lot of synergy. And in fact, one night we were just walking after rehearsal together. And he said, you know, I feel like maybe we should just make our own company. And I said, well, interesting, you should mention that. I was never going to impose that upon you, but since you brought it up, and that was,
it has been the master plan all along.
Yeah. I was actually quite conscious of not suggesting it, because I really wanted it to be something that felt like it was of equal interest and collaboration, and not like making someone do something that they were only half really entertaining in their mind. So yeah, it was great timing, and Carolyn was really supportive. We continued to dance for her while we started the company. She said something very interesting when I told her privately that we were going to start the dance company in a meeting. And she said, can I tell you something? I said, of course. She said, it's a really bad time to start a dance company. And I said, thanks, Carolyn. It's always a bad time to start a company. And then she said, if I can offer one piece of advice, learn Excel. And I have never forgotten that. And I have really stepped out of the way for Aaron to become the whiz kid with Excel.
That's so funny. Yeah, for anybody out there developing a dance company for the future, make sure you know how to rock a spreadsheet, because that is going to make or break your dance company. Forget about choreo. Forget about ideas. You got to know the spreadsheets. That's what it's about.
Yeah. Well, it speaks to how dancers have to do everything.
Yeah.
You choreograph, you budget, you do the admin. I mean, dancers are the most overloaded people I know. and usually some of the smartest, which is why it's funny that people like to say that one. Why would you be a dancer when you could be a lawyer? It's like, you don't know dancers.
Because we can't not. Yeah. I just wanted to go back and make two quick points in response to things that you guys said earlier. First, just in honor of our significant others, I know Aaron mentioned that we got into a relationship when we first were early on in starting the company. Actually, we were in a relationship first and then we started the company. And we did not stay in that relationship romantically, but we did stay always partners. And we're really happy to have the support of the other people in our lives that are just like really enthusiastic about the company and the work that Aaron and I do together.
That's great. Cool. Yeah. Thanks for clarifying. I wouldn't have known.
And then also just when you asked about the difference in our background and our training and like the ballet and tap, I just wanted to touch on that because I started with ballet and Aaron started with tap. And then I went into, you know, flamenco and African and modern and street dance. And Aaron went into ballet and then and modern. So funnily enough, in the end, I was less strict about my ballet training than he ended up being with his more conservatory-based education. So it's funny because even he says when we first met the first time, he really thought that I was like a very serious ballerina. And I would like to think that, you know, I can come across that way. But when it comes to terminology and certain technical elements, like, he definitely, you know, Ande or and Ande Dan, like I still have to like think about which one is which every
which
single
way is time. The door, which way is the door moving? Yes. Yes,
like on it comes like from the back. So that's interesting. But between like tap and flamenco and African, they all involve a lot of rhythm, but a different way of placing your weight. And so it's an interesting take on how we approach rhythm and timing. With flamenco, you know, you've got little metal things underneath. They're usually like little nails on the bottom of the shoe. And on a tap shoe, you also have the metal plates.
The taps. Yeah.
The taps, yeah, thank you. And the difference really being that when you're doing flamenco, you are directing your energy very strongly downward. And it's very earthy and grounded. And in tap, there tends to be a lot more of like a light foot or the ability to move the foot quickly by keeping it light and lifting it up and moving it back and forth. So there's a different emphasis, I think, on how the weight is used there. And then modern wise, we ended up, even though we're not in the same exact generation, we're not in totally different generations. We kind of overlap a little bit. So we both had very similar modern training, in fact. So it's just interesting where we have actual crossover and where we diverge and how that really comes together and complements each other's background.
Well, it's interesting that you say and comment on that. It sort of is a good segue into the next question that we sort of put together when we were putting together this interview, which has to deal with your company and the sort of description of your style, which we have on here from your site, quote, "With articulate nuance and explosive athleticism, BSP's collaborative style infuses fresh perspective on subjects ranging from mathematics to complexities of human nature." So the question was, how do you sort of explore complex topics through dance? Specifically, what was the one that you dealt with mathematics? But then again, using that, your sort of different backgrounds that you obviously have this rhythmic tie coming from flamenco and tap, like you sort of talked about, but talk a little bit about how you sort of explore those complexities through that athletic and explosive style that you have.
Yeah, I think, you know, we deal with that in a very individual way for each piece and each process. And I think there are certain like through lines that we probably use commonly over time. But for the most part, we look at each piece that we want to make and sort of look at what is the process for this? What would really bring this to life and honor this topic or idea really in the highest way? So it can very much depend. So for example, we have a piece called Hot Knife and Cold Butter / Flow Through Me. And this is a piece that's an evening length piece. It's about 45 minutes. And it's made up of several sections that really explore the different facets of human beings in their life and their work and their development. And it was in honor of my mother, and so I took it kind of from her life, as people would say that she was like a diamond and she had so many different facets that would sparkle in different ways. And I sort of took that and made each section another facet. So all the way from exploring formulaic development, like behavioral development, cognition, and just like stages of relating to oneself and the world, all the way to code switching, which was an area of expertise of my mother. And if you're not familiar with that, it's a linguistic term, which really deals with people who speak in different languages switching back and forth amongst themselves within those languages, right? So we call it, some people might call it Spanglish if it's like English and Spanish, you know?
Sure.
But it occurs in so many different ways. So we would take that concept and explore it with movement. And how can you create code switching with movement? And so we would do a little, there was a little bit of research, but not so much because I knew much from my mother's research, but a lot of discussion with the dancers also and their experiences. And in that particular case, we all developed our own short language. And we started with just four movements. Each person is going to say something made up of four words, and each of those words gets a movement. And from that, you develop your language. And now you don't know anybody else's. You only know your own, and you're going to come into a meeting with another person who only knows their language via movement. Mm. And we would play games like, okay, you can speak with your movement. And once you see the other person's movement, you're allowed to absorb it and adopt it as if you're learning their language. And then you can use it and transform it in your own way as if it were your accent or your way of adjusting your grammar or the context. Mm-hmm. And so that was one way that we approached, you know, the complexities of something and applied that concept into movement. And then to answer your question more specifically about the math piece, that was a very interesting unfolding. I'll say a little bit about the beginning and then I'll let Aaron elaborate. We know a mathematician. And one morning I was walking with this mathematician and his name is Jim Simons. And he was telling me about a workshop that was going to be held on the theories of differential cohomology and twisted K-theory that would be part of like the opening ceremonies for this new Simons Center for Geometry and Physics that he and his wife had built at Stony Brook University. So he was telling me about the workshop, and then he started telling me about the theory. And as I often did, I was visualizing all kinds of dances as he's talking about, you know, physics and mathematics. And then he stopped and he said, "It really sounds like a dance." And I said, "Yeah, it really does." And he said, "That's not a bad idea. What do you think about making a dance based on the theory for the opening events?" And then literally within 2 hours, emails were flying back and forth between offices and it was commissioned for an evening. And so that was how that developed. Although it's an extremely advanced math theory, he says that you would need 4 years of graduate studies to understand that theory alone. But Aaron and I looked for some ways to create a narrative and follow a structure where mathematicians could see their theory, the theory illuminated, but non-mathematicians could just enjoy like a really good dance and not feel totally abandoned.
Right.
So Aaron has great stories about how we dealt with that. So Aaron, take it away.
So like as Kyla said, he asked us to create a piece based on the theory, but he was like, "You can't understand it. It's beyond you." But he gave us a lecture on it. And it was like an hour and a half long, like lesson on like some of the basics. He defined like seven terms. He spoke in very like general terms about what it was about. It's about finding the surface area of like spheres and donuts and how, if he heard me say this, he'd probably be like, "You don't remember." it's about like topical geometry in a certain way. But he explained to us, it starts off that everything, there's these commutative groups, I don't even know what that means, but they sit on a hexagon, and there's a diagram, and these these mathematical formulas. They can move in different directions. And when they do that, they're like mappings of different things. And ultimately, at the end of their journey, they get canceled out to zero, like crushed to zero, he would say, killed or whatever. But he was explaining this whole theory to us in a, is it anthropomorphic? Is that the word? Like giving a lot of human characteristics. He was basically telling us a almost human story as he described the mathematics to us. And then he was talking about certain characteristics. So there's physical characteristics that we were latching on to, like maybe certain parts were heavy or light or angular versus curved and different properties. But there was also a story he was telling us. And we were really kind of drawn to that. You know, he's a mathematician. And as dancers, oftentimes you would think, oh, a mathematician is very dry, you know, just thinking numbers and lines. And no, the way he thinks about this math that he developed is very creative. And it's out of the box a lot. You know, he's using a lot of images and things that help him understand it. And that was really interesting to us. And we're really driven a lot by like emotional content, and our work has a lot of that in it. So we decided that we would blend those two ideas. We would take the elements of the math that are there, that are more concrete, but we would also infuse it with the story. And so this piece, which turned out to be like a 36-minute piece, has a narrative. It's abstract, but it tells a story, and it's purposefully very emotionally engaging because that's how he described it to us. And we were really, really drawn into that.
Wow. Yeah,
even mathematicians and artists, we all speak the same language ultimately. I mean, it's stories and connections of human motion and relationships are what drives everything.
Just wanted to ask you guys a quick follow-up about the whole math concept, because Kyla, you said something interesting. You said that Jim said to you, as he was describing his theory, I think, that it sounded like a dance, or it sounded like dance. I mean, I don't know if you can remember specifically what he was saying, but how did it sound like dance? What do you think it was that struck him in what he was saying that sounded like movement?
Yeah. So as Aaron mentioned, the theory is based on a hexagonal diagram. And on each point of the diagram, each of the six points, the commutative groups sit. The deal is they can only move on certain trajectories, and they can only go so far before they're canceled to zero. And so when he was talking about it, he was talking about how, like, well, this commutative group can move from here to there, and then it can like attach itself to this other group, and then they can move this far. But actually, the center couple, they can move in different directions, but there are these rules where it can only go from left to right, but the center couple, they're allowed to tiptoe back to center. And he goes, wait a minute. So it's as if you have a train, and it's like this one commutative group hops on the train, and they go to the center point, and they pick up this other couple that's on the train. But then when they get to the bottom point of the hexagon, then they die. They're crushed to zero, they die. Except for that center couple gets to detach and tiptoe back to their home plate.
It does sound like a dance.
Yeah. So there was that. And then there was also just the way he was talking about the topology and the spheres and the donuts. And well, if you're measuring the surface of a sphere, it's not the same as measuring the surface of a donut because of the hole in the middle. And then if you twist it, then you have a pretzel. And then, you know, a pretzel is really the same as a donut, but not the same as a sphere. And so he was really talking about like the surfaces and the qualities of those surfaces and how they can bend and shape and move. And additionally, when he was talking about the eight terms he needed to define in order for us to even understand anything he was talking about, there was a lot of personality in each of those definitions and words, and the way he would just actually like his own body language and nonverbals as he would describe things. And he would talk about certain things like, well, an eight isn't just an eight. An eight's like a guy, you know, and the number eight, it's like, you know, like a guy who's kind of, you know, jolly or, you know, whatever.
So, of course.
So much personification in all of it that was, you know, that was, I think, where he got that and what appealed to us too in the storytelling.
That sounds so fun. Cool. I just had to ask, and now we can move on. And actually, let's talk about Accidental Suite. It came from your titles project of five dance films, from what we understand. How did you develop those dance films? And I guess, how did you then expand Accidental Suite into a live production?
So a long time ago, I started a list of just things that would come to mind throughout the day, just like a little, you know, notepad or scratch paper, usually an envelope that I had thrown the contents out from, and I would just scribble on it. Different things that were like titles. Oh my God, that sounds like such a great title. I'd love to explore that and make a piece to that title. That would be a title I would make up, not the title of a book or something. And I would just keep track of this. And anytime we would have the opportunity to choose our own project, we would go to the list and say, okay, what's on this list that we're like dying to create right now? What's the most relevant and interesting? That list got to be so long that no one could ever make that many pieces in a life. It was like more than 250 titles. It was like crazy. Unless each was a very short film. And so all of a sudden we were like, oh, short films, coffee table book, ebook. You know, we started really like going and going about where we could take this idea. And so we decided to embark on a process where we narrowed down the list of titles and we worked with the dancers and they helped us narrow it down even more based on like what they thought was really interesting for them as movers and intellectuals. And then we had initially started thinking that we would do cycles. Like we would do 6-week cycles where the first week we explore the concept itself. And then the second week we get into the studio and improvise. And the third week we set the choreography. And the fourth week we go and find a spot and rehearse it on location and film it and then edit it and release it and then go to the next title the following week. That became a little unrealistic as we went through the planning and everything. And so we decided to take a step back and actually just create the films first and then release them one by one instead of create, release, create, release, create, release. So that was sort of how the project began. And we ended up making 5 out of the like 250.
So far, you've made five.
And for the most part, they were collaborations. I generated a lot of the movement. Aaron did a lot of the shot list and editing. And we also worked with other filmmakers in collaboration. And then Accidental Suite had its own process. So I don't know if it's time to go into that just yet. But it was at the time, you know, just one of the 5 films. And then after releasing them online, 1 per week, we let the audience select the one they wanted to see expanded. And that was Accidental Suite. Yeah.
That's great. I think it is time to go into that. Yeah.
Cool.
Perfect.
So Accidental Suite was really that. It was really an accidental suite. And when we went into the studio to do the titles project, we had our titles and we were going to have a process in the studio where we each did our individual warm-ups. And then we did a contact improv warm-up to get more connected. And it was through these contact improv warm-ups, in fact, that the vignettes came to be. So as we were doing these contact improv warm-ups, we realized that we were creating dances. We weren't just like warming up. They were uncannily structured dances. And so we ended up videoing all of those improvs and then going back and crafting these several vignettes. And the title that we had started with the first day that happened was Things That Dissolve. And interestingly, in order to demonstrate something dissolving, you have to make it solidify first. So we would have to connect and create something that could then be dissolved.
Right.
And so then these forms of connection started to come into play. What are all these varying types of connections? There were remote impressions like butterfly or ripple effect connections. There were connections by design like architecture and the connections that one's brain makes just by way of seeing two things in the same space at the same time. There were connections where they're more surface oriented, like an acquaintance. Or getting to know someone gradually. And then there are really interdependent connections. And there are connections that we hold through memory, history, and reflection. And so we dove deeper into those forms of connection and created one of the sections for the film. And then once that was selected, we went further into all of the other vignettes that explored the other forms of connection.
So in relation to the ones that are being explored off film, sort of on stage and in real life, one of the questions that Clara and Jess had come up with was this idea of how interesting and ironic, in a sense, that you've created this piece that is being postponed because of being around and being in social distancing, but it's so reliant on physical touch. That must be some sort of like weird mind-boggling thing for you guys. But at the same time, it's when you do have a chance to perform it in real life, it's going to be make it so much more integral to the piece. But do you think this will sort of inspire any changes to it? Or do you think that this will inspire a different piece? Or how do you think that this whole coronavirus, COVID-19 social distancing affects this piece that's so relatable because of its physical touch?
Yeah, I guess that remains to be seen. I mean, for sure, I'd like to be optimistic and think that we're all going to be able to do this together in the near future with the same cast that created it and everything. And so I would like to think that it will just be a really refreshing glass of water when we do it together, and we'll all be more in need than we'd ever been before. I like to think that it created an opportunity for a really amazing group of people to engage in very deep connection for a good chunk of time before we had to take a break from physical contact. But I think, you know, we'll have to see how things evolve. And right now it's already a little over 30 minutes. So I hesitate to say we'll expand it even further.
Well, that's interesting, the idea of coming back to it after not being allowed to have physical touch or to have physical relationships with people. You know, that's the weirdest thing for everyone, is you just can't be in the same room unless you live with someone. And even then, it's like 6 feet, at least if you're roommates like me. You know, I live with four roommates, keep our distance. And I was curious, from your description of Accidental Suite, if it deliberately left off the word contact. I can't find the description now, but it didn't say contact between the dancers. And then I know that you guys do some work drawing in the audience. So I'm curious if Accidental Suite is meant to draw in the audience and have contact between audience members and dancers as well, or is it kind of separated out?
It is separated out. We had entertained doing it in a way that would be a little bit more interactive during the dance by changing facings and having the audience move so that there would be a different background for each vignette in the space, because it's a flexible space.
Cool.
However, some of the logistics felt like it might make people uncomfortable to a certain extent, and we certainly didn't want to do that. So instead, we felt like if we had a pre-party and we're all able to socialize and the dance kind of emerges in the space, even though it is set up in a proscenium facing, it's not going to feel like a proscenium dance or a proscenium event, because it's really using the space. And so even though it doesn't like come from behind the audience or anything like that and engulf them, I think it would really feel like they are sharing the space with the dance and not separate from it, watching it from afar.
That's so cool. I love that. When I read that it was wrapped in a party, I was like, this is great. Like, first of all, it's a way to get people interested in dance and having fun with it, which is something we talk about all the time, because it's kind of a crisis in the dance community that our audience is dying out, literally. And it's a challenge to get new people interested in dance, especially people who didn't grow up with it. But if they're partying before and after, and the piece kind of emerges from the party, and I guess in some sense, maybe back into the party, then that's great. Who doesn't want to go to a party?
Yeah.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, traditionally you go to a theater, you sit in your chair, you don't talk to the person next to you. And the whole Titles project from its inception was about engaging people, engaging with us, of course, but engaging with each other too. You know, what they thought about things, and, you know, all the comments that could be left online, and the connecting, we went to do it live. It was important to us not to just give them a show and have them go on their way, but for also for the people that come to the show to interact with each other, interact with the dancers, have a chance to talk to the dancers afterwards, but share comments with the fellow audience, you know, and bring people together in that way too, not just with us, but with each other. That was the goal and the structure that we'd set up. And I, you know, I hope we're going to do it sometime in the future, but I think it's in this day and age, not a coronavirus excluding that. It's what's needed in this world, I think, is to just take a moment to purposefully engage with each other. So that's
in a way, I mean, I guess that's our answer. Once you get to do the piece, it will probably feel so much more poignant, and I bet you'll succeed with that kind of interaction in the audience even more because people will be so hungry for it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
True.
Sure. And but since it had been our 10th anniversary, which is technically now over, but we for that did a series of more like informal events and open rehearsal type things. And we got to spend a lot more time with smaller groups as audience members and really just talk and get to know each other better and talk about the work. And as much as we love performing in big theaters, of course, it often, you know, by the time you come out from backstage, there's only so many people that are still there and wanting to talk. And so it just seemed like after that series of events that we'd had this year, that Titles Project also should be like one of those ways of connecting more deeply on the spot with the audience while dancing.
So looking at everything, a little bit of a bird's eye view, point of view here, right? 10 years in, obviously engagement is a big thing for you. Engaging your audiences physically or emotionally, obviously. What do you look forward to at your 20-year anniversary? What do you want to have looked at, back on in the next 10 years from now? And ultimately, what are the goals of the company? Where do you want to see this build to over the next decade?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing is for sure. We would really love, whether it's in the near future or the long term, to be able to provide more stable living wages and benefits for dancers, not just our own even. So that's a big goal of ours. And we've steadily worked, you know, toward being able to do more and more. But, you know, we are not yet on like a full-time 52 week contract kind of situation. So it would be really great if we could get there. We've also talked about opening our own space and the type of programming that we would have in the space, which is a little different from what other dance organizations do with their space. But really, I think beyond making dances, our greatest concern of late is dancers and just like anybody else deserve, you know, a living wage and good healthcare. So I have to say, like, especially this week, that's what our eyes are on. That's what our mission has been. And this is like diverging a little bit, but we really are working hard to figure out how we can continue to pay the dancers. Technically, they would be on a break as of Saturday until the next project began. However, knowing that they don't have other projects lined up and waiting for them, and most of their backup jobs have been canceled, we're just working kind of feverishly to figure out how we can keep them paid, keep them safe, keep them healthy, keep them in New York if they want to be, of course. And so having said that, we're working on, just like a lot of other organizations, creating a list of resources, both for people to contribute to help and for dancers to draw from. And we are right now exploring the possibilities of creating a dancer relief fund. And we started working on this a couple of days ago, and we've seen since that there are a lot of emergency relief funds going on now. But so far, not that many of them are really just for dancers who specifically were working and have lost all of their jobs this last week.
Yeah. And a lot are for like $500, which is, you know, it's people trying to do what they can. Organizations trying to do what they can, but it's not a lot.
Yeah.
Be groceries for a few weeks, but
yeah.
Cover the rent.
Go ahead.
Hey, if I could go as far as our also goals, I know for me, it's this last year has been really special in that our audience has connected with us in such a way that if I could dream as to what I would also want would be that the audience feels like we're their company. Like, you know, we've been creating a family, so to speak, for the past, you know, 10 years. But, you know, when they think of us, we feel like we're theirs. Mm. And that, I think that's powerful. I think that's what people need and what people want. And the more that we not only show them our dance, but the more that we as humans just connect with them, talk with them, share our lives and our ideas and our fears and all that stuff with people, the more they feel connected, and the more they feel like somebody's creating art for them, not just for them to come and watch, but for them.
So. Interesting. You know, cool. Everything you guys are saying, I think, is advancing the dance community as a whole towards the living wage and towards some of these goals, because you're doing all of these things that, like I kind of alluded before, really do promote engagement or have the potential to promote engagement among new audiences for dance. I mean, you're making dance films. That's very accessible and an easy way for new audiences to engage. Wrapping your events and parties, it sounds like you have an audience that really follows you. This is amazing. I'm wondering how purposeful that is, if it's geared towards this kind of idea of increasing engagement or if it's just what you're doing. And I guess I'm curious if you have any statistics on this audience that you're talking about, Aaron, and whether they come from dance backgrounds or not. Just curious about that.
Some do, like, obviously, you know, and like the dancers have friends and they're, a lot of them are dancers and that for sure. But also, you know, a lot of them are not. And a lot of them even come from like other staff that we have that have invited them in, that may come from the finance world or from just, you know, other forms of work that has nothing to do with the arts. So that's, I feel, great. Like we're really kind of expanding in all directions. And, you know, they always say, like, you know, you want to choose your demographic or who are you promoting? And it's hard for anybody to give that answer. But the more our family grows, the less pinpointed it really feels, the more like that it feels like it's a lot of different people. So maybe there's something specific they all have, but it's not age, it's not gender, it's not any one of those things. It's something else.
Dance for the people.
Yeah.
I think I love it. I love our analytics because of that, because when we look at all of the metrics and everything, even though it doesn't capture every detail, it really does show the span and the level of diversity across the board, whether it's, you know, age, gender, where you live, which, you know, number of countries that people are following us from. And I think that part of what goes on, and some of this is deliberate and intentional, part of it is just like who we are. And that is that I think that people really are able to relate, or some people are really able to relate, not just because they've connected with us on a personal level outside of the dance, but because there's something that we try to bring to the dance that lets people see themselves in us. And, you know, we work to be very representative of many different things. And I think that that really embeds itself in some ways in what we call like the DNA of a dance. So the more we have a discussion within the company about all different, you know, religions and backgrounds when we're making our piece based on the Divine Comedy, you know, the more we all become all of those things. And are able to embody them, and people are able to experience something that is somewhat universal. And I think that that's important to us, because I think in our original mission statement or bio from like way 10 years ago, it had said something about finding commonalities and appreciating differences.
Hmm.
And I think that, Aaron, by the way, I was thinking we should maybe go back and look at some of our original materials and see, you know, how far we may have gone from some of those ideas and how much we may have actually gone, you know, full circle and come back to some of them.
That's so cool. I mean, you know, looking at you guys and having developed a company that's so inclusive, representative, engaging, working to build a community for your audience that feels like you are theirs is something super special. I mean, I think it's probably like sort of a good place to sort of wrap it up here, but I think you guys working towards doing that, I think is the kind of thing people want to hear right now and look forward to hearing right now. Like you said, a tall drink of water that we'll all be very refreshingly looking forward to drinking when we are able to get back together and celebrate community again, physically, I think is something really, really special. And the fact that that's sort of the foundation of your company is really, really cool. So thank you guys for spending the afternoon with us, albeit, you know, separately in our own
evening over places, here, Michael.
But but yeah, you guys are awesome, and thank you very much.
Thank you both.
This has been really great. I just wanted to, before we sign off, let you know that about the math piece. At our last performance, the vice president of the Sloan Foundation saw the performance and asked us to present the piece again in New York City.
Wow.
The Sloan Foundation very generously gave us a grant to do that.
Woo! That's awesome.
Yeah, so we're hoping that will be, you know, it was supposed to be in the fall, but we'll see if we can get it up in the fall or not. And in the meantime, there's also a documentary that was made on the process and the piece itself that you can see, I think, from our website or our Vimeo page. And so you can actually see Jim giving a little bit of that lecture and talking a little bit about the theory and how everything came about, if you want.
Shout out those links. What's the, where would people find that?
That would be on the repertory page of our website, which is BarkinSellisonProject.org. There's a repertory tab, and as you scroll down, you know, we have all the pieces listed, and there's a little video link that'll pop right up and show the documentary.
Check it out.
Awesome. And we'll post the link to that as well in our post. Anything else you want to promote before we sign off?
Peace and calm in these troubled times.
Yeah. I know. Good luck, everyone. You guys should run workshops on audience engagement for everyone. Zoom workshops.
Actually, that's a good idea.
add it to your list. We don't have enough to do yet. Cool. Well, thanks, guys. Hopefully we'll catch up later at your dance party for Accidental Suite.
That would be fantastic. That would be fantastic. We'd love to have you as our guest when it happens.
Looking forward to that, for sure.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, guys.